This is the way it feels to move through summer in Lululemon. Iconic align softness without the front seam. For our smoothest look and feel ever, summer won't know what hit it. Stretch your limits in the non-stop flexibility of the new Lululemon Align No Line Pant in select stores and at lululemon.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Emmerik Arnold, founder and CEO of Agora Pulse.
Do not raise money if you don't know what to do with the money. VC firms and investors are going to tell you that you're going to get more than money, but it's a little bit more than money. Money is 90% of what you're going to get. And if you don't know how to leverage that money, you've basically just given away part of your company for something that you're not going to get value from.
This is Emmerik. He's a serial entrepreneur with over 20 years of experience in social media and software as a service. He co-founded Affinities, one of the first modern social network SaaS platforms in France, in the early 2000s. In 2010, he founded Agora Pulse, a social media platform. He grew it from generating 140K in annual revenue to achieving the same figure every 3 days, without taking significant outside funding. This makes Agora Pulse an inspiring bootstrap SaaS success story. And hence, I invited Emmerik to my podcast. We explore his insights on what it takes to create a successful B2B SaaS company without having to rely on external funding. He shares his big lessons learned running the business through a PLG motion and explains why they have pivoted to a sales-led SaaS motion, thereby moving upmarket. Last but not least, he elaborates on his approach to customer segmentation, creating measurable business value, and how to enable constant evolution. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn 4 things. Firstly, why you should prioritize and investing in amazing customer support, especially when bootstrapping and the product is still evolving. Secondly, how to go about hiring people that have the highest chance to bring your company success. Thirdly, what to focus on when you want to transition from a PLG to a sales-led SaaS motion. And lastly, his first principle when it comes to prioritizing features to create products people start talking about and keep talking about. Well, hi, Emmerik. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
That's my pleasure. Thank you for welcoming me and picking my brain.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I got inspired by listening to a podcast from one of my peers and friends from the Netherlands, Joran Hofman, the Grow Your SaaS podcast. Yeah. And I got intrigued with a couple of things you said, so I had to invite you to dig further into the conversation on that. Before we start talking about your company, Agora Pulse, what drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
Learning and progress. Feeling progress as a professional, as a founder, as a business builder, like feeling like I'm gaining knowledge that's valuable, that's going to help me for the next thing, whatever the next thing could be.
Yeah.
Or the next project or the next go-to-market that we have to build, like whatever it is. When I feel I'm gaining something of value for myself, I feel good. When I feel I'm learning something that I can then leverage to help the business, help my team, help myself, then I feel good as well. And when I discover a new way to do something that's a bit creative, that's a bit on the edge, that makes me feel good too. So it's all about creating and learning, basically.
Yeah, that's the typical entrepreneurial way. And I mean, I feel exactly the same about that thing as well. I mean, I left the corporate world in 2017 and I thought I knew everything. Boy, was I wrong. And well, boy, what fun is it to be able to learn so much more.
Yeah, well, the older you grow, the less we know and the more we realize it, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's being challenged and giving yourself challenges as well. So making the bridge then to your company, Agora Pulse, I've read a couple of things on it online. You founded the company in 2010, but online it says that it took 12 years of failing until you founded the company.
Yeah, my co-founder and I, we actually started the business, the corporation behind the business in 2000, July of 2000. Yeah. So it's 24 years ago. We failed at a first business that was called Affinities between 2000, 2001. We actually launched the website in 2001 and the technology. It was a SaaS product already. And we tried hard at it until 2009 and 10, until we started to pivot to Facebook. Because before it was, building your own community online, basically, that was the previous product. We pivoted to building stuff on top of Facebook, initially contests and promotions and sweepstakes. Early 11, we decided to basically take all these contest promotions and sweepstakes that we built on Facebook bespoke and merge them into a platform that people could use self-serve. That was the first iteration of Agora Pulse, which we launched in August of 2011.
Yeah.
And from there, we pivoted twice, which we obviously today we don't have sweepstakes and promotions on Facebook. That's all gone. That market has disappeared. So from there on, it was all a matter of adapting to the market and evolving with the market to stay relevant and first to become relevant and to stay relevant and then to create more and more value for the customers by, changing the value you build and the value you offer to the market. So it's a constant evolution, which obviously comes with constant learning and also struggles, lots of struggles for sure. And that's the story in a 3 minute.
Exactly. Well, we have some time to go around that. So at some point you decided to go Facebook. We build a couple of things there, and in 2011 you said that's where you originally founded Agora Pilsen.
Yeah.
What was the problem that was sort of screaming for a solution that wasn't around then to make that jump?
Yeah, the problem when we launched Agora Pulse is that basically a contest and promotion when we were selling them as sort of an agency, because that's what we were doing, building them bespoke for large brands who wanted to run a photo contest on Facebook. And it was a very, very early day of the fan pages. So yeah, you have to put yourself back 12 years ago and it was a very different world back then. The problem was that those contest promotions, sweepstakes, and so on and so forth, they did cost, or in the early days, we were able to sell them for 15,000 euros. Uh-huh. And then with more and more competition in the space, we were able to sell them for like 7,000-8,000 euros. And the problem was like those contests and promotions bespoke were so expensive to build that, most of the market at the time needed a solution that they could use self-serve for $100. And there was a first company that got started in the US that was called Wildfire. And Wildfire was basically selling those contests and promotions for $100 that it was out of the box, build it yourself. And as soon as we saw that, that's what led to the building of Agora Pulse, because we said, okay, we wanted to build software, not an agency. With our first iteration of the business from 2000 to 2010, this is exactly our dream. So let's build that in Europe, because there was nobody doing that in Europe at the time. And the problem that we wanted to solve is like industrialize something that was costing a lot of money and make it cost very little money and make it very accessible.
Exactly. I like the word industrialize here, because so many people are using disrupting and revolutionizing. That's exactly what you're doing, industrializing it. That's fascinating. And then, and now I also understand where the distinction comes from, the service to a SaaS business. You bootstrapped the business. That was also one of the things I learned in the other podcast. You bootstrapped it for a very, very long time, even though
still today
around you.
Still bootstrapped.
Exactly. So why have you never made that jump from bootstrap to a funded business.
In the first couple of years, when things were really harsh, the answer is very simple. Nobody wanted to give us money.
I heard that's
I tried several times, and I was not able to convince investors. They basically thought that at the time when I tried, you know, social media, I was done. It was too late. Like, it was not fancy. It was not fashionable anymore. So, like, it was a question of timing. Then we hit product market fit and break even in 2015. 100K MR, 100K spend a month. So, like, exactly break even in November 2015. And after that, we grew quite fast. In 2016, we grew 150% from 100 to 250K a month. And then I think again 100% again. Like, it went quite fast in 2016, 17, 18. Until 2019, the growth was very, very solid. And we basically said no to fundraising that would have cost me 20% of the company for absolutely no added value, because at that time when we said no, when I looked at my bank account 2 years later, we've added like 4 million on the bank account. So we would not have consumed the fund raise, and I would have lost a fifth of the market, of the capital. So thank you, Lord, for making me not take that money and say no to it. So basically, in the first couple of years, it was nobody would give me money. And once we hit break even and we were profitable, it was me realizing that, well, I make enough money. I don't need external money. Yeah. I will not know how to use it. And I think that's the key learning, is that if you don't have a clear plan to leverage the money that you raise into more growth or you know, like a healthy expansion in a foreign country, then do not raise the money, because what's going to happen is twofold. It's either going to be sitting on your bank account and you're going to give away a big chunk of your company for nothing, which I see a lot of people do, by the way, because they just react to, oh, it's nice, I can post on TechCrunch that I've raised money. Well, just so you know, spoiler alert, nobody cares that you raise money except but you and your investors. And the TechCrunch person who writes the article, like, nobody else does. I don't know who raised and didn't raise money. I have no clue, and I don't care at all. So if you have a good product, you solve my problem, I'm going to buy you. I don't care if you're listed on the stock exchange or if you raise money. It doesn't matter. So that's number one. And the second thing I see as well is people who raise a lot of money. So now they have a lot of cash. And when you have a lot of cash, you make much more expensive mistakes. So when you don't have a lot of cash, your mistakes have a constraint. They cannot be that bad, because if they are, you go bankrupt. And as a business owner, you're protective of your business. So you're making sure that your mistakes are not gonna put you in danger, right?
Yeah.
When you have dozens and dozens of millions on your bank account, you're gonna multiply the number of zeros you add on your mistakes. And I've seen that over and over again. And I think that's one of the big benefits of bootstrapping, is that your mistakes are going to be cheaper. I still make a lot of mistakes to this day.
Sure. Everyone does.
Yeah. I have the constraint of not making them a 10 million euro mistake, but a 1 million euro mistake if possible, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So what about this? I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Sure.
That notion of, okay, the moment you you get capital in and you got traction, now you can start to grow even faster. You can, instead of 150% growth, you can do 3x and 4x and 5x. Do you believe that's true?
Yeah, it's true if you have the right business unit economics. Yeah. It's true if your churn is at a certain level, if your expansion, if your go-to-market is nailed and you know how to get more of it. If all of these things are not true, then adding more cash in the business is not going to change a thing. So every time I've been struggling with plateau in our growth, and that's, by the way, completely transparently something we're going through right now. We've been pivoting and migrating from a business that was mainly driven by SMB and self-service and inbound to a business that needs to be driven by more mid-market and sales-led motion. And that's a challenging pivot. That's very hard to do. And that usually comes with a plateau where by the time you learn to do the new thing and the old thing is kind of, you know, eroding and moving away and getting flat, you're probably going to have a couple of years that are not going to be fun and are not going to be high growth, high fun, all that kind of stuff. Basically, you cannot force function that success. You just have to go through the pain. That's what it is. And the money is not going to make it less painful.
Well, like you say,
once you figured it out and you have the motion and you have the engine and your unit economics are healthy and your NRR is 100% plus, then pouring money on the business could be a good idea. So it's not always a bad idea to raise money. It's a bad idea to raise money when you're not clear on how the money is going to be leveraged to grow the business.
Completely agree with that one. So wise words here. On that journey, you said you had to pivot twice, two big pivots. I mean, I come from the enterprise software world and I've seen a couple of pivots as well with when we were developing the thing. One was not even a market type shift, although the market, of course, was shifting from the on-premise world to SaaS, to cloud.
Mm-hmm.
When did you make the decision to say, okay, well, until here and no further, we have to do something radically different? Because I mean, what I see a lot in companies is sort of the complacency, like, yeah, this is not real. This quarter was bad because of this, and ignoring what's really going on. How did you spell out this is the problem?
Yeah, you know, nothing fancy. It's knowing your business KPIs and metrics very, very well and reading through them and identifying as you go through them that that's going to be a problem. I'm going to tell you what KPIs I looked at in 2012 to tell the team that we have to move away from contests and promotions on Facebook. I mean, our monthly churn was 20%. Even in 2012, a 20% monthly churn is a death sentence, right? So very, very quickly, we realized that, okay. And by the way, for us, it was already better than the previous business, because the previous business we had from 2001 until 2010 was the business that allowed you to build your own community online after almost 10 years of existence, was at 150K ARR. So today I make 150K AR in 2 days, I guess, something like that. So contest and promotion business on Facebook, even with a 20% net MR churn, still felt better than the one we had before, right? But I quickly saw that I wanted more, obviously, and I wanted the business to be healthy.
Yeah.
And I immediately realized that in order for a business to be healthy, it has to be a SaaS, B2B SaaS business. It has to be the piece of software that someone in the company is using every day. It has to be the core function of one job in the company, whatever it is, you know, accounting, finance, planning, product, engineering, whatever it is, sales. You have to sell to a function of the company and they have to use you every day. If you're used once a month and once a year, once a quarter, you're done. That's it. There's no business. It's not going to be healthy. The metrics are not going to be healthy.
Let me make a small interruption here. Emmerich just made an excellent remark about the underlying success driver for his company. The constant focus on solving valuable and high priority problems that manifest themselves every single day. Solving a valuable and high priority problem is always a good start. Don't get me wrong. But its impact increases the moment frequency kicks in. That's when you know you got something that's sticky, and stickiness is essential to building a healthy business. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. First, they acknowledge that they cannot please everyone. Then they create something that's both valuable and desirable. And then lastly, they focus on delivering that in a way that's different, not just better. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So we looked at who we sold to. There were community managers at the time and we said, okay, what do community managers need? And in 2011, they were already using, you know, Buffer was already there, and yeah. Hootsuite was already there. And I said, okay, that's what we need. That's the direction we need to take. We need to help them do their daily job. And then daily job is post content on social, measure how that's working on social, and manage the engagement in comments and private messages. Yeah. Back then, that industry was nascent. It was only like our larger competitor today is Sprout Social. Sprout Social was barely a thing in 2011. Sprinklr was starting. All these companies were basically starting, were babies.
Yeah. But
today, obviously, it's a different story because they all raised a lot of money, and so they became big. That's the first realization that, you know, if you're used once in a while, you're never going to be a big business. So that was the first pivot.
Yeah.
The second big pivot was to realize that, oh, we sell to small businesses, and for small businesses, the problem we solve is not big enough. So because it's not big enough, they're not ready to pay us big enough money. And they will churn at a higher rate because, like, yeah, whatever, let's go native, or let's use a cheaper tools. You know, who cares about this fancy feature and this advanced whatever it is?
Sure.
Because the problem is small. So I'm ready to pay less for something that's a little clunky, but that's not solving a big problem for me anyway. So that's something we realized 3 years ago. And moving up market is a pivot because you basically have to change so many things in your company. Yeah, and sometimes you have to change so many people because they know how to do marketing for an SMB crowd, but they don't know how to do marketing for a mid-market crowd, or they knew how to sell to an SMB crowd. They don't know how to sell to a mid-market crowd. So the level of pain you have to go through to make that pivot work is staggering.
Yeah, exactly. No, I know all about it. It's a PLG at the end is, you say a small business, but sometimes it can be a single user. Yeah, you know? And you're talking about an investment of €15 a month rather than €1,500 a month.
Yeah,
you might be able to serve that channel functionality-wise, but they will never become real fans. That is in the connection.
Yeah, at some point you have to make a choice. Like today, the product we sell at €49 a month is not that different from the product we sell at €10,000 a month. And at some point you have to realize that at selling at 49, what you have built at 49 is basically a waste of your energy, and you shouldn't sell it to 49. So you have to make the decision that it's not the right thing to do and remove that. Our competition that's higher end has done that already for most of them. And the ones who don't, I'm not going to name names. I'm not betting on their future. I think you cannot serve everybody. You have to make a decision as to who you serve to be consistent.
Exactly. Chapter number one of my book, Remarkable Software Companies Understand They Cannot Please Everyone.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very tough choice to make because it's mental.
Absolutely.
Once you get over that, a lot of things get a lot easier. Exactly. In that journey, what has been an early decision that you took that has been very important for the success that you have today?
Well, as a bootstrap company, a decision that I made early or that I stuck with, and I still stick with that today, when you are not entirely sure about where to invest your money, there's one aspect of the business where it will always be a good idea to invest money. It's the customer support aspect. So very early on in the business, when I was not, should I hire an engineer, an additional developer, or an additional or a designer, or, you know, marketer? And we didn't have sales for a long, long time. When I was in doubt, I always thought, okay, well, let's invest in delighting the customer. And delighting the customer when our product was clunky and not finished and far from perfect. Because, you know, bootstrapped also has its constraints, which is it's going to take you a lot of time to get to the place where you want to get to, product-wise and positioning-wise. I've always, in the early years, prioritized investing in support and providing an amazing support experience. And I think that was quite helpful for us. If you go check our reviews on G2, we're ranking super high.
Yeah,
and you know, I could not say it's because of the product. I think it's because of the way we treat customers.
No, I mean, one makes up for the other. And together it becomes a good experience. People love you for that.
And then your product catches up and then it becomes good. But you've been able to build a business, not because you had an amazing product 5 years ago, but you had amazing customer service and people forgave you about your imperfect product at the time. If you're a bootstrap or the product you have to build is complex and you're far, it's probably a great investment. Invest in amazing customer support because that you control. The product, you don't. You have to be patient and it's going to take time. And again, that's an area where pouring millions of dollars is not going to speed up things that much. You have to go through customer discovery, doing the initial MVP, testing the MVP. That time you cannot compress it that much. You can compress it a little bit, but not that much.
No, and it doesn't help if you throw more people at it. It just you need the iteration to make it perfect because what you think is good is at the end it's going to turn out radically different with customers. So talking about a journey with getting to your first, I'm not sure how many customers you have.
8,000.
8,000, all right. So what were the, I mean, because you started with PLG. Now you're moving towards sales-led growth. What have you learned in that period now from moving from product-led to sales-led? What were things that you have discovered that you would love to know before?
Wow, that's a loaded question because there's so much you have to discover in that transition. I think the number one thing is when you're PLG and you're based on a free trial, and even if you have a little bit of a sales, like an order-taking motion, I would call it more than a sales motion. All your go-to-market is built around the product, the features, how it works, what you can do with it. When you move to a sales-led motion, all the motion has to be around the value, the problem, the fit between the two. So you basically, and that's something that you have to break with SMB sellers. They talk about the product. Mid-market sellers, they talk about the pain, the problem. They go and then they hunt for it, they fish for it. And once they get, when they've hooked it, then they're able to say, oh yeah, I can see a fit between this pain I've just identified with you and this solution that we offer. Can we talk about that? And then only then they get into this is how this is going to solve your pain. Right. So I think that's probably one of the main difference. There's so many, we can talk for an hour on that. But another thing that became quite obvious to me is when you're inbound PLG, you have very little control about who you attract. Very little, if any.
Yeah.
So anybody will come to you. And if you're successful, like we were lucky to be, then you're going to have hundreds of people trying your product every week. And a proportion of them converting into paid customers. Not really knowing why. You won't really know why. You just need, it works. I'm not sure why, but it works.
Yeah.
The problem with that is if you're not attracting the right customers, you're going to stay stuck with them. If you're attracting customers that are churning at 6% a month, you're going to stay stuck with them. You're going to keep attracting customers who churn at 6% a month or 5 or 4, whatever that is, like negative NRR, net retention revenue, net retention rate. If you want to attract a specific kind of customers, PLG is not the way. PLG is not going to cut it. Because you have to be intentional about who you talk to. So the kind of content you create, the kind of webinars you do, the kind of events, the kind of everything, it has to be intentionally targeted and built to be of interest to this persona in that type of company, in that size of company, in that vertical. And that you cannot do with a PLG motion. Impossible. Impossible. Because in the PLG motion, what you're basically doing, I call that the spray and pray strategy, is you make as much noise as possible in the places where your customers gather, the communities, the forums, the Facebook groups, the blogs of your influencers, like SEO, content, Google search, G2. You identify all those places where the kind of people who are buying your software gather and get their content and get their insights and get their questions answered, and you build a presence there. That's how we build a 0 to 10 million without raising money. That's that we did it this way.
Yeah.
once you go up market and you want to attract, okay, we need to attract companies of with more than 10 hotels in the hospitality industry with international locations and multiple languages. That's very, very specific. Yeah. With strategy number one, there's no way you're gonna attract one like that a quarter, maybe two, three a year, but it's gonna be random and it's gonna be luck.
Yeah, true.
If you want to get 20 of them in Q3, then you have to be very intentional about creating content for hotel chains that have multiple language and multiple international location. What are the specific problems of these hotels? Yeah. How the brand is, you know, how do you respond in multiple language to all you know, guests who come from all over the world, and whatever it is, the needs and the pains are going to be specific to them, and you need to write to that pain and those needs, and then make them come to you because, yeah, I have those pains. Can you help me?
Yeah.
And that means that everything you do marketing-wise and then sales-wise has to be designed to appeal to a specific persona in a specific vertical for a specific company size in a specific part of the world. So that's a huge difference between the PLG motion and the sales-led motion. Huge difference. When you think, so the product versus the pain is number one, the specific persona versus the anyone who wants to come to me, I'll take them. Number two. Number three, I think because we've been a little amateur with the PLG motion, I think you can be a little amateur when you're doing, you know, Sprint, Prey, PLG, come to my product, do a free trial, and some of them convert. When you're going mid-market, when you're going up-market, when you're building the product to go up-market, like, there's less and less room for amateurism. Lovely. Everything has to be highly professional. Everyone, you know, basically you have fewer and fewer generalists in the team, and you have more and more specialists who are really, really good at their craft and what they do. Yeah. And that's something I've seen in the tech team, I've seen in the marketing team, I've seen in the sales team. So, for example, we didn't have sales enablement before. Now it's a function that's absolutely necessary for us.
Yeah.
We didn't have SDR, BDR. Now that's a function we know we have to build. We're struggling there. It's difficult. Yeah. So like when we were PLG, we could do a lot with generalists who had lots of good intentions and work really, really hard. Right now, I know the future will not be made of that. We'll have to be really, really good at our craft at each and every single job that we need for that motion to work. So I would say the three main things that I'm witnessing right now.
Very well. I mean, I love how you articulated that, and I completely agree. The bar is just raising, you know. You enter sort of the Champions League in the particular area. Because at the end, what you're talking about, for the small business and for the individual users, the stake is not high.
Yeah.
For the league that you're currently entering, the stake is super high. And as a consequence, they're going to be very careful in terms of how they're making the decisions. Yeah. Looking at the time, oh my gosh, this is flying by. I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and it's about the specific traits that these companies develop to build something that stands out, that people find worth making a remark about.
Yeah.
What have you on your list that you steer for in the company, your teams, to kind of create something that is being talked about outside of the four walls of your company?
Yeah, well, we touched that earlier when we discussed my vision for what we solve on the market. Is that, of course, we're sold for social media chaos and making that chaos manageable and you know, putting it all in the same place. But I think we're no different than every other social media management software that do the same thing. Obviously, we could argue for 35 minutes about why this one thing we do it better than the others, and that one thing is, you know, a better color or easier to use or whatever. But at the end of the day, the market does not care that much. You know, we got 8,000 customers who are probably good enough, but the others have, you know, Sprout Social at 25,000, they're probably good enough too, and Hootsuite is, you know, thousands, so they're probably good enough. Who knows? In order to find out, you're going to have to spend dozens of hours testing all the... No, nobody does that. They pick a product based on how convinced they are that this is going to be a good solution to their problems. So that is not enough to be remarkable. My vision to be remarkable has always been since day one that social media is only worth doing if it creates business value. if it does not create business value and it's just yet another fancy marketing thing, shiny object that you can do, then, you know, number one, I'm not excited about pursuing this. As simple as that. And number two, I don't think anybody should. And we've built Agorapulse since day one with the idea that we have to find all the possible ways to make this measurable in a way that the people who use our software are going to gain value for themselves by using the software. So the software is going to help them see the impact of what they do, measure the impact of what they do, and feel good about their job and feel good about the value they deliver to their customer, to their agency, or to their boss and their CEO if they're working for a company. That's our vision. Now, in order to make that vision touchable, like people can touch it, we need to tell stories about how we can make that happen. So now our job is to be storytellers of this is how you do it, and this is how we can help you do it. And that's my obsession, is like, how do we create stories that validate the vision, that makes the vision a reality and not just yet another marketing play? And that's all I spend my time on as a CEO. And by the way, I'm also leading marketing now. So I'm like even more obsessed by that, because I think great marketers are great storytellers, and we need to tell stories that the people we sell to want to hear, that make them feel that we solve their biggest problems.
Yeah, couldn't have said it better myself. Completely right on that one. And I also like that your vision is about the change that you want to create in the world, rather than I want to become $1 billion software company.
It's not a vision. It's a wish.
No, exactly. It's a wish, yeah, exactly. But when you do the other part really, really well, the growth will come, and possibly then 1 billion will be even enough. But that's a completely different story. Last question.
Yeah.
From your entrepreneurial journey now for good 24 years, the wisdom that you gained there, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with entrepreneurs that aspire something similar?
Just one?
Just pick one.
There are so many do's and don'ts.
What's the most controversial, maybe?
The most controversial would be, do not raise money if you don't know what to do with the money. Do not raise money. And again, I have almost raised money at one point because I felt it would make me part of the team, you know, part of the ones who, part of the successful ones, because, and it's stupid, but I'm pretty sure a lot of founders feel that way, because I felt that way at one point. So that is for sure. VC firms and investors are going to tell you that you're going to get more than money. It is true that if you're lucky and you have a good one, you're going to get a little bit more than money, but it's a little bit more than money. Money is 90% of what you're going to get. Maybe 10%, if you're lucky, is going to be introductions, directions, and sometimes, you know, helping you steer in the right direction when you're lost, which happens sometimes. But the value of having investors is 90% getting the cash and 10%, maybe 15% more than that. So do not overvalue what that is. That's what it is. And if you don't know how to leverage that money, you've basically just given away part of your company for something that you're not going to get value from, which makes you feel very bad once you realize it. I can tell you that.
Exactly.
I have friends who feel very bad today because of that. That would be one. I'm trying to think something actionable based on the mistakes we've made. I think the biggest learning is that the most expensive things that you can do and the expensive mistakes or bad decisions are almost always people decisions. It's almost always having the wrong person in the wrong seat, or the right person in the wrong seat, or the wrong person in the right seat, you know, depending on how the mistake is made, not defining the seat or not testing for the right person. And if I had one piece of advice that's actionable, that would have avoided me the very, very costly mistakes I've made with people I hired that were not the right people. Number one is define. So there's a book called Who that has an interesting concept that says that you need to have a scorecard for the role. The problem is they don't really define what that scorecard should look like, but the advice is right, but the how to implement the advice is not clear enough. So it took me years to understand how to do that. But basically, what you need to do is a scorecard of 5 or 6 things that you expect the person on the job to deliver. And go around, if you're not sure, go around and talk to people who've hired people like that and had success or didn't have success and ask them, what do you think made them successful? What do you think made them unsuccessful? And do not save that time. And I've made that mistake. If you do not do that, yes, you're going to save 2 or 3 days of work. Yes, for sure. But you're going to waste dozens or hundreds of days of pain, of missed opportunities, of, you know, missed revenues, whatever, because you will not have defined what is that I should expect from the role, from that person in the role. And when you think about what these things you should expect, think of them in a situational way. Like, what do they look like in the doing? How do you know if they're done or not done? Like, what does that look like in practice? Let's take an example. So if you're hiring a account executive, for example, a sales guy, don't write reach your quota. I want them to reach their quota, and that's a scorecard. Like, what's their ability to reach their quota? No, go and write ability to discover. Because if you interview someone, how are you going to know if they can reach their quota or not? You're not. You will not know. Because in the way you interview the person, there will be no question that will help you know if, whether or not they're going to be able to achieve their quota. But if the element in the scorecard is know how to discover, do customer discovery and discover the pains and the needs of the customer, now you can ask questions. That's very situational. Okay, that's very interesting. So tell me, you're on a call with a new potential customer, and your goal is to discover why they came to you. What questions do you ask? And then you go for the questions. Oh, I asked this, I asked that. And then if you have done this yourself, you'll quickly know if they will be good at discovering the pains of the customer. So all your, I know it's a long-winded answer, but in the way you test people, first identify the things you want them to be good at and make those things testable in an interview and situational, and not about the objective, but about the how you get to the objective.
Yeah, true.
And things that they are expected to do that are evidence that they know how to do their job. So it's hard. It takes time to uncover, especially if you've never done the job. So if you're hiring for a job you've never done yourself, it's even more difficult. And that's where you have to go on LinkedIn, find people who are doing that job or have people who do that job in their team, and interrogate them almost. Sure. To get to those, okay, what would you test for? What would you ask? What specific questions would you ask? Just one last example. I was hiring for an HR position at some point, and I wanted that HR person to train my managers. And I got a couple who said, yeah, I love training. I love training managers. That's amazing. Like, they were all, you know, every time they were very, very excited about training managers, and they've done that in the past. And so the way I questioned them was, oh, that's great, you've done that in the past, so tell me about the last time you did it. Where was it? Who attended? What time did it start? What was the first item on the agenda? So I went very, very, very deep into, okay, tell me how you actually freaking did it the last time you did it. And trust me, if they have done it well, their story is going to sound amazing. If they have not done it, or they've just participated into one that they did not build themselves, but they were sitting in the room, their story is going to suck. And that's how you know if they know how to do the job. And that's probably the hardest learning and the most expensive learning I've had. And still today, for every hiring, I'm like always obsessing about how do we test for the things that we need to test for, so we minimize the risk of not hiring the right person.
Fantastic answer. Very actionable. Loved it. Thank you very much. Where can people go to find out more about Agora Pills or to say hi to you?
Yeah, they can go on LinkedIn. To say hi to me, they can always go on LinkedIn. If they want to connect with me on LinkedIn because they would have questions or they would like to pick my brain, when it happens 10 times a day, I barely find the time. But when it's, you know, once a month, I take the time. They can always send me an invite on LinkedIn. just add a message saying, hey, I heard you on, you know, Tom's podcast and da-da-da-da. So at least I know where it's coming, because I receive so many invites that I only respond to the ones that make an introduction.
Okay, cool.
And AgoraPulse is going to be AgoraPulse, AgoraPulse.com online, and you can do a free trial. There is even a free account now, so you can see for yourself how it works.
Nice. Well, thank you very much. It was a true pleasure to talk to you.
It was a pleasure talking to you too. Have a great day.
Same. And this ends my conversation with Emmerich, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspires you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Emmerich Arnold, founder and CEO of AgoraPulse. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.